Welcome to Energy Matters, where we explore alternative health in the Pioneer Valley. I'm your host, Caroline Rutterman, and I'm a Reiki professional and intuitive in Northampton, Massachusetts. For the past 9 years, I've been teaching people how to use their intuition and helping them reduce stress and anxiety. Together, we'll talk with other practitioners and learn how they bring health and healing to the Pioneer Valley. Let's do this. Hey everyone, this is Caroline Rutterman with Energy Matters, and we are here today, and it's a little bit of a cloudy day today, but we're here to receive a little sunshine from local herbalist who we're interviewing with Brittany Wood Nickerson of timeherbal.com. And we have some great discussions. We're going to talk about some recipes from her cookbook and some online courses and all kinds of good stuff today. So I'd like to introduce our guest of Brittany Wood Nickerson.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn.
I'd love to hear a little bit about this new cookbook that you created. It's called Recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen. I found this cookbook when I was at Arcadia Herbals in Northampton, which is my new favorite place in Northampton. And I don't know why it took me so long to find that place, because I've been walking by it for years and years. And then the first time I went in there, I was like, oh my gosh, this is heaven on earth here. It's like my people. But I saw they have a really, really nice display of your cookbooks and your posters and a bunch of your pamphlets and zines. And it's a beautiful book. And that was, when was that published? When did this come out?
It came out last June. I'm about to come up on the 1 year anniversary. So it was 2017.
Wow, that's so cool. That's so cool. And it sounds like you've been cooking your whole life.
Yeah, I have been. And when I came to herbalism, it really, I came to herbalism in college. So it was sort of a natural meshing of the two, because I was exploring cooking more and more, and I was also learning about herbs. And so I started cooking with both culinary and medicinal herbs as I was learning about the herbs. And really, I was learning about herbs, but I was learning about the body and health and digestion, and food as medicine was just sort of a natural outgrowth of that. And so when I started my practice as an herbalist, I was really focusing in on the food as medicine piece. And it still remains an important part of my practice as an herbalist and as a healer, and for multiple reasons. One, because I really believe that the food we eat is our medicine, and it's very important what we put in our body.
Absolutely.
But also because I think that food is an invitation to engage in a really intentional and healing way with our lifestyle. And so what you'll find in the book are recipes, cooking with herbs, often large amounts of herbs, and recipes for using food as medicine, but you'll also find that lifestyle component kind of locked in there. So we have that mind, body, spirit healing all coming together.
That's really cool. And I do really, you know, I feel like that's kind of one of the like core underpinnings of Ayurvedic, which is, you know, the Indian form of, you know, medicinal cooking. And, you know, it's the same thing. It's like, it's preventative. It's the cure to what our ails are. It's kind of all wrapped up in how we eat. And, you know, even, you know, in Ayurveda, having a khichdi is, you know, like this mono diet of, you know, resetting our systems, and it's all the food that we eat, you know. It's and I think that's it's a really big concept, you know, when we have a big snacking culture, and, you know, it's kind of food on the go, and a lot of that kind of quick, you know, very like machine produced type of food. It's really it's a total kind of flipping it on the head of like how we eat, of like thinking as of food as medicine rather than just like food to sustain ourselves, you know what I mean, just like a quick bite so that we have enough fuel to like keep going and doing what else we want to do.
Yeah, and it's actually a trap that the health food industry has fallen into as well. You know, a lot of healthy foods and superfoods are marketed as on-the-go foods, and, you know, bars and snack foods and you know, this kind of stuff and convenience foods. And I would argue that, sure, we need to change and pay attention to the foods we're eating, but I actually think as much as anything, we need to pay attention to and transform the culture we have around how we're eating those foods and how we're preparing them. And so Ayurveda is a big focus in my work, and it's traditional Indian medicine, and it is actually not just like a healing system, it's a way of life. And so it includes lifestyle and diet and herbal therapeutics that can help somebody be in balance based on their individual constitution. And we each have a unique constitution. So it's completely tailored to the individual. And it includes things like food preparation, how you can prepare the food to be best for your body and to make it most digestible. And then it also includes, like, you know, sitting down for meals and eating mindfully. And in Ayurveda, they actually say that you're not supposed to talk a lot during meals, or, you know, certainly not supposed to get into intense conversations during meals. You're certainly not supposed to eat in the car or while you're watching TV, right? And so, you know, of course, I have a daughter now, and every once in a while I have to just give her a snack in the car because that's just how it is. So yeah. I don't want to demonize those things, but I also think that for us to reframe our lives so that the norm is more and the standard is that we're sort of, you know, intentionally consuming our food, intentionally as consumers, intentionally creating our food in our kitchens and then intentionally eating it, goes a long way towards our wellness, as much if not more than what we're eating, right? So that food is medicine sort of expanded to beyond the what you're eating into the how we're eating it.
Right, right. And I, you know, I'm a single woman, and I am very, I don't want to use the language of guilty, but I am a little bit guilty of eating in front of the TV. And that was something that my mom mm-hmm. and my dad never let us watch TV when we were growing up. But, you know, yep. when it's just me and my cats hanging out and I'm like, yep. oh, I just got home and I'm, you know, eating this food and I kind of want to catch up on a show. It's very much, I tend to eat a lot faster when I'm watching TV. Yep. And before I know it, I'm like, oh, my meal's gone already. And I just kind of like, mm-hmm. it was just spoon to mouth. It was just, it often yeah. is very mechanical style eating. Yeah. And, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if I necessarily have any complaints about it, but it is an observation mm-hmm. that, that, you know, when I am watching TV and eating my dinner at the end yeah. of the night, then that does tend to, I guess, I don't know. Maybe
influence. I would say influence.
Yeah. I was going to, that's a much nicer word. I was going to use the word dissociate, but I think that influence is, you know, or yeah. disconnect. I think, you know, there's a little bit of a disconnect between, like, you know, the food, you know, because when I'm preparing it, I'm looking at it. Sometimes I'm singing or, you know, yeah. I'm kind of putting a little bit of Reiki into my food just as kind of like, you know, a blessing or a thank you. So as yeah. I'm preparing it, but yeah, the eating, the like watching your food as you're eating and kind of communing with it is also, I think, a really important part of the process.
Yeah, and there might be like different steps that we can take to influence the decisions that we're making around food. So, for example, like you're noticing, your observation is that eating in front of the TV influences the same way you would notice that if you were really anxious and having like a hard conversation with a friend, you probably wouldn't want to eat. Or if you were like at a festivity, you would want, you know, it's like all these things just influence us. And so we can influence, you know, without even changing our habits in large ways, we can start to influence. So, you know, a quiet moment with your food of gratitude before you turn the TV on, as an example. Or I had a client once and she lived alone and she really couldn't handle. She was eating in front of the, listening to NPR.
Oh, yeah.
And she told me that the news stressed her out. And so I was like, you know, stress and eating are like the worst combination.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
It's called stress
and
eating.
So, so I was like, you know, it's like, we just need to kind of work on calming that chatter. So she couldn't eat in silence. She wasn't ready for that. It was too lonely for her.
Oh,
and
yeah.
so we did lighting a candle and reading instead of her listening to NPR. So there's always like transitions we can make, compromises we can make, influences that might feel like they're healthier or more supportive to us or for us. So
yeah,
I think there's a lot of ways we can approach it. But it reminds me of you saying, how did I walk by Acadia Herbals so many times and never go in before?
Right.
Like we find exactly what we need, exactly when we're ready.
Yeah.
And so I just really believe that to be true. And so, you know, that sometimes in our life we go through times where we have certain habits that are serving us for whatever reason, when we're ready, we change them or transform them.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's really poignant. And I think that's kind of important to remember. That's like, you know, it's not a matter of like wasting all those years or like lost years into before we reintroduce these habits that turn us into, you know, kind of help us grow in this other new direction. But yeah, it's just kind of where we are at right now. Yeah. And, you know, and that's fine.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. So can you give us a little, maybe a little recipe or a delicious morsel snack type idea that, I know we're talking about the opposite of snacks is slowing down, but, do you maybe have, could you share, a little recipe from your book? I'd love to,
sure.
Think about some of that.
Yeah. So I'm going to, the book is set up in the non-traditional way for a cookbook. Most cookbooks are set up either seasonally or they're set up around types of dishes, salads, main courses, snacks, entrees.
Oh, yeah.
And my book is set up around recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen is set up around relationships with food. And so the chapters are nourish, invigorate, comfort, transform, adapt, and share.
Okay. I like
and
that.
And so, yeah, thank you. And so that's a large piece of how that lifestyle comes in. So I think I'll start with something from that's sort of seasonally appropriate and also coming from the nourish chapter, which is the first chapter. And one of the things I really focus on a lot in my work is this idea that yes, we're nourished by our food, but we're also nourished by our thoughts and our emotions and, you know, our lifestyle essentially. So,
yeah.
So this is, I'm going to read the head note to baked eggs with parsley pesto. And this is a really simple, really amazing, recipe. You can make any kind of pesto as your base.
Okay.
And this is a parsley pesto, which I really love. And it's a 1/3 cup pine nuts, 2 cups packed fresh parsley leaves, 3 cloves of garlic, 1/4 cup of olive oil, and some salt. And you would food process that, and that's your pesto. And you can use that in any recipe. But and what I do is and then 8 eggs.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're gonna combine those first ingredients. Leaving out the Parmesan. If you were making this pesto for something else, you might want to put the Parmesan in.
Okay.
But we're actually going to use the Parmesan differently. So you're going to make the pesto, and then you are going to put a teaspoon. You're going to use individual ramekins.
Okay.
So like serving size 4 or 6 ounce ramekins.
Okay.
And you put about a teaspoon of the parsley pesto in the bottom of each ramekin, and you crack an egg on top.
Oh.
And then you put another couple of teaspoons on top with a little bit of the Parmesan on top. And then you are baking them at 425 for about 7 to 8 minutes if you want a runny yolk, and 10 to 12 minutes if you want a firmer yolk. That's my favorite way. If you have really large ramekins, you can actually do 2 eggs in each ramekin.
Okay.
And just, you know, add a little bit, proportionally a little more pesto and a little more cheese.
Awesome.
I end up kind of liking to make them in just the individual ramekins. But
so cool.
These are really, you know, especially if you already have the pesto pre-made, but even if you don't, they're pretty nice, kind of fanciest breakfast, brunch, or lunch.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like that's like a really like quick brunch meal too. Like if you have a bunch of people over, that you could have, you know, the coffee brewing and have those baking, and as soon as they come out of the oven, be ready to go with everybody. That sounds great.
Yeah, and they're really just so delicious, so flavorful. And I know like for myself right now, I have just my parsley is like really just becoming robust enough to be able to make something like this from the garden. But you can also, the other thing I love about this parsley pesto is you can buy parsley any time of year for relatively inexpensive in the grocery store.
Yeah.
But you can't say the same about basil, right? So parsley becomes not only really delicious, but a highly nutritious base for pesto.
Oh, That's really smart. If you're just tuning in, we are chatting with Brittany Wood Nickerson of thymeherbal.com, and she's sharing a pesto, baked egg pesto recipe from the recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen cookbook that just came out last year. I want to kind of get into your brain a little bit, because I love cooking. I tend to work a little bit more from recipes. Do you, because you're a recipe creator, right? Like you mm-hmm. like dream and then you taste and then you like season and then taste more. Is that how this goes? Like, how do you like wake up and you're like, I'm gonna make this thing? Or do you have, you know, like 2 pounds of like herbs that you have to get through that particular day? Or how does...
I have a quota of herbs that I have to get through.
Yeah. It's like the pressure of having a CSA when you're like, I have so many vegetables, like I'm gonna make these.
Right. Well, sometimes, but actually, just to get us started on that, let me answer that question. I'm going to read the head note, which is the introduction to a recipe for another recipe about eggs, which is parsley and tomato steamed eggs. And I'm not going to go through the whole recipe, but just to say it's a bed of sauteed parsley and onions with tomatoes, and you saute that just very briefly, and then you crack the eggs over it and steam the eggs on top of this tomato parsley base.
Wow.
So here's a head note. The best days start with a slow transition from the world of sleeping and dreaming to the world of waking life. When I can, I like to linger in that soft, gentle place, giving myself time to enjoy the peace and observe the contrast it can have with the everyday pace of things. It can also be a time with greater access to your consciousness and creative inspiration. This recipe emerged from such a place. Wandering into the kitchen one morning, I just knew that this dish would be the perfect thing for breakfast. Perhaps it was the tomato on the counter, the crisp, fresh onions in the fridge, or the sweet, salty smell of parsley that often haunts my dreams. This recipe presents yet another opportunity to transform seasonal bounty into a celebration for the senses.
I think
that it varies for me. Thank you very much. I think it varies for me, but I really do have a lot of those moments where it's sort of like the spirit moves me, and maybe it is the tomato on the counter. Maybe it's walking to the farmer's market and, you know, my brain just connects. Like last weekend it was the ramps from Hart Farm and the lion's mane mushroom from Rico Tierra, and, you know, somehow polenta came up in my brain, and next thing you know, like, the meal is planned, right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's that. Sometimes it is, it's that there's, like, a certain ingredient that I'm interested in. Like, every spring I find myself really drawn towards goat cheese and, like, sour dairy and then the fresh herbs come up. So that was sort of an inspiration for the cover image of recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen, which is lemon roasted asparagus with baked goat cheese medallions that are breaded in fresh oregano, chives, and toasted pecan.
And those, that is what honestly like caught my attention, because they're, I'm just going to describe what I remember seeing on the cover, is that they're almost like these little, they're like about the size of falafels, right? So like they're these little round white, or like light colored small patties, and they are just flecked with herbs, and they are over a bed of greens, and it's just, I mean, or with asparagus, you said, right, is underneath it. Okay. Yeah. I'm like trying to, this is like a test of like, do you remember what this photo looks like? And sometimes you pass and sometimes you don't, and I was just, I mean, my mouth started watering as soon as I was looking at this picture, and I was like, this is a good book. And, you know, like for me, that's really inspiring when I see the food photography, and, you know, like there's that expression that we eat with our eyes, you know, like we see something, you know, everyone's walked up to a counter, you know, at the Roost or whatever, and they have that huge display of pastries in front of you, and you're like, your mouth starts watering when you look at the cake or, you know, whatever kind of calls you. And it's like, that's the first step is like, you know, visually taking in that food. And I think the photography in your book is just stunning, and it's a really nice book just to even, you know, gloss through. And, you know, even when I'm not always cooking, I like to look through cookbooks. Like that's just a pleasure place for me when I'm having my afternoon tea. And you know, so if anyone's listening and they're kind of thinking about getting a gift for anyone that likes to cook, Recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen by Brittany Wood Nickerson is a keeper. And I did see that they sell it at Acadia Herbals. So it's also supporting a local shop to purchase it through there. And I know you also sell it on your website on thymeherbals.com, and that's thyme like the plant, so thyme herbal.com.
And you can order it through any, you know, bookstore, or they also carry it at Broadside Books in Northampton.
Awesome.
So I think what you're talking about, this idea of eating with your eyes. I mean, I think that that's largely how a lot of the inspiration for cooking comes in too, is, you know, it is that sensation of like the mouth waters for something, or something comes into your thought process, or you see something that appeals to you. And sometimes you see that and then you go looking for recipes to get ideas. And other times the ideas just kind of come to you.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people who love cookbooks, but they don't follow recipes.
Right.
I'm similar. I have cookbooks. And when I don't know what to make for dinner, I kind of, you know, sift through them when I need ideas. I don't always follow the recipes, but, you know, I might think, oh, pancetta, that's a good idea. I haven't cooked with pancetta in a long time, you know?
What is pancetta?
It's a type of cured pork, almost like a prosciutto.
Gotcha. Okay.
But it's, you know, it has slightly different, and, you know, something like that, and so you get ideas. And then once you get the idea, sometimes I glance around at recipes. The way I have a tendency to use recipes is to look around at several recipes to get an idea of how the formula of that particular dish is working. So, for example, like if I want to make a cream sauce, I'll look around and be like, what's the basic like premise of making cream sauce?
Right.
As a simple example, you know?
Absolutely.
Most of them make a roux. Are there any that don't make roux? And how would that work? And then I start to experiment around and usually make my own.
Absolutely.
From there.
And
yeah.
I think that's, it's interesting too, because I think that, you know, a lot of what I'm doing, because, you know, I don't eat meat or dairy, but I often, you know, a lot of people who are vegans or plant-based diets have, you know, we call it veganizing something. So it's like you find the recipe and then you tinker around with ways to make your substitutions and until you can achieve something that is identical or as near to that original as you can get. So it's not like we have to ever sacrifice anything with our cooking or our creative, you know, like spirits for that meal. Usually it's just replacing a couple of ingredients and you can still get that same creaminess, or, you know, and I think that people that experience, you know, any kind of dietary issues, you know, have that same sort of process of like, yeah, let me like kind of do a little compare and contrast and we'll make it work. So it's, you know, it's like, you can't do it wrong.
And,
if it tastes good, you can't
do
it wrong.
Yeah. Too. You develop your go-tos. Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit more about your kind of creative stuff that you do, because as I was looking through, you've really published a lot of stuff over the last, how many years has it been since you have started publishing? Because I see that you have a spring cleaning pamphlet.
The other way to talk about it would be to call it a zine. I often call them zines.
Absolutely.
This is a kind of shorthand for a self-published magazine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that has a lot of the like kind of DIY, like the do-it-yourself kind of culture underneath it too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we don't have to go through this big publishing to kind of share information. And yeah, absolutely. And it's a lot of the sort of 90s, like, you know, like chick rock from the spirit behind it too.
Totally. And as you say, it has a rich history of people and a heritage of sort of like talking about new ideas in that form.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And just spreading them around among friends, you know, it's like, so you've been doing this, there's a spring cleaning pamphlet. It looks like you had a whole nother zine that was like cooking for winter wellness, all about like soups and stocks. The Herbal Homestead Journal, which was very intriguing. Like when you've been writing, like writing seems like it's a huge part of your teaching.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny how things evolve because I didn't necessarily, you know, set out to be an herbalist who was a writer. But it just ended up being a good fit for me. So Time Herbal is 10 years old this May. Ooh, so right now.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congrats.
Thank you. And so, gosh, I want to say maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, one of my students, who's a dear friend, Chelsea Granger, and I, we sat down. She's an artist, and we decided that we were going to have monthly meetings with each other to create, talk about our creative process, and potentially, you know, hold ourselves. All that
so
kind of stuff.
Important. So important. Yeah. Not just for business owners, but creatives. Like having that accountability buddy is so important. Oh my gosh. Okay, I'm loving it.
Yeah, good. Yeah, and just, that's one of the big, that's food, sitting down for a meal, creating space. You know, it's like we have to create space for the things we love to be able to creation, to manifest, really.
Yeah. And just and to so, a little bit, like the idea of like creating space is a time, right? Like creating the physical and the time. Can you talk a little bit more about what this is just to kind of like kind of get what you're saying, but just, you know, Totally. Ish that out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Really important. Between time and space, and actually there's a recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen, space, they're slightly different. I think that creating space is about what, you know, a word and the definition of the word, but it's about creating a spaciousness around something. So that when we have space for something, we have, the mind is not full of chatter, it's not full of distraction, and it's able to really be present for what we're at. Or where we're at, or what we're trying to focus on. So a really great example, whereas time is about physically creating time, and you might need a chunk of it, right? Hmm. So, of course, there's a connection there, and we need both. But, like, the example in the book that's so perfect is that let's say I'm trying to think of what I'm going to make for dinner before I leave the house in the morning. I don't necessarily need much time to be able to, you know, pull something out of the freezer or throw some dry beans in a pot of water to soak. But I do need to have the spaciousness to not be so distracted by my life and my other obligations to think ahead to dinner.
Okay, so we're talking about like a mental spaciousness, like a presence of like the here and now to be like connected to how we're feeling, like just a little like airiness, a little energetic airiness to...
That's one type of space, and I think a very important type of space that we often overlook. And then I think the other type of space is to create space that is time, right? So we might need to, in the case of me sitting with Chelsea, my collaborative friend, to make a creative space for ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's also time, right? We're going to make a space to have this manifest in our lives, and we're going to meet every month. So we are setting aside time. And maybe one of the things we talk about is how to make more time for our creative practice in our life.
Cool.
And then the third type of space that I think about is the creating of a safe container, or the creating of like a space that fosters some kind of creation. So that might be, you know, lighting a candle with a meal creates and holds space for that meal to take place. You blow it out at the end of the meal.
Yeah, I like
having
that.
Like an altar that you maybe like sit with to say a prayer or to honor a loved one or to set an intention, you are creating a physical space that you are, you know, then using as a way to hold space for that intention or that, you know, gratitude or whatever it is that you're working with.
I love that.
So I think there's a lot of different ways to think about space. And I think it's really, really important. And so I'm glad you kind of pulled that out.
Yeah.
Because I just said it in passing, but I do think it's important to think about from a more formal perspective, if you will.
Yeah, because I think it's something that, like, is an idea that gets kind of, like, tossed around, and it's like, wow, like, that just, in my mind right now, just opened up two different avenues of what creating space is. You know, I like mm-hmm. that a lot. Yeah. So that's often something that, you know, that idea of creating space. It's like when I sit down and I do work, I often light a candle, especially if it's, you know, a time where I maybe am kind of really asking myself to sit down and do some work for an hour, you know, instead of having a timer, I'll often light a candle and be like, you know what, you know, exactly. So I like that concept of creating a space and creating, doing some of that. So, so a lot of
and
these,
we have a lot of ways we do that in our lives and maybe, you know, don't think of it that way, but that is what we're doing. Like, that's what you're doing when you light the candle. It's just a little ritual that you have.
Yeah. So a lot of your creative work came from, you basically sitting down with your friend, creating a space for you both to, have like your process together.
Well, sort of. That's just the beginning of the story. So we sat down to have this meeting and we decided that we were going to start collaborating on making posters together.
Cool.
And I don't think we ever met again in that intentional way.
Oh, okay.
I don't think we ever did our monthly meetings.
Yeah.
But out of it came this collaboration that we've had ever since. And so our first collaboration was that we were going to make a moon calendar to chart menstruation on.
Oh.
And the idea is that it would have some information on it and have the moons of that year. And that was the intention, was to chart menstruation. We still make a moon calendar every year.
Cool.
But so I sat down to write the information for the moon calendar, and I basically wrote a book. And I printed it out, and I was like, I looked at it, I was like, there's no way that we can fit this on a poster.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So Chelsea and I made a poster with a tiny bit of information and a zine to accompany it, which is Sacred and Mysterious.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that.
Yeah, and so from there, it just kind of blossomed. I actually had already had most of the material from the Cooking for Winter Health booklet created for a workshop that I had been teaching, and so I just kind of expanded on that. And then the Herbal Homestead Journal is a really beautiful story. Atlas Farm in Deerfield, they have an amazing farm store, and they're such a wonderful, inspiring, organic farm. But
it's
they
Atlas Farm, you said?
Yeah. In Deerfield.
Gotcha.
And they have a whole farm store of all local stuff, and it's so great. It's kind of the best because you can buy a market share card, which gives you a discount to shop there. So it's kind of like having a CSA, but you can buy whatever you want. And they stock from a variety of local growers, so they often have like just a good diversity of stuff. So
that's really
I love
cool.
Atlas Farm Store. But anyways, and they sell my books if anyone's looking for them.
All right. Yeah, it's another local shop to go and support.
Another local shop to go check out. So they had a CSA for a little while, and one of my students was working there and had a herb add-on. So you could become a CSA member. You could also have a medicinal herb CSA add-on. And she approached me about writing a newsletter for the add-on.
Cool.
And so I started writing this newsletter. So every month when they picked up their share, they got a little journal, and it was a four page thing. And I wrote it every month. And a couple years later, I was like, this is what, I only wrote it for 1 year, but a couple years later, I was like, this is such a gem. Mm. And so I put it together into a book, the Herbal Homestead Journal. And it's so great for people that are, especially, I think it's great for anybody at any level, because if you're just starting out, it's very accessible to month by month read, you know, one kind of section, have one introduction to herbal medicine every month. And if you're not just starting out, and you like herbalism is really already something that you practice, it keeps you in it. It's like every month becomes a reminder of something that you can do or engage in, and it keeps you connected with the season, and it kind of keeps that flow going.
Yeah. And that's, you know, kind of bringing up that like idea of, as herbalists, whether you're, you know, kind of like casually just, you know, making what's in your backyard or, you know, creating from what's in your garden. I think that herbalists are some of the most well-connected people because, first of all, they're always learning. You know, there's this endless desire to, like, keep learning, to keep taking courses. And I find that when you're like excited about learning stuff, you also have that flip side of kind of enjoying sharing information and teaching. Mm-hmm. And I feel like herbalists, whenever, you know, I meet somebody who's into that world, there's just so much, you know, kind of like resource sharing and activism that goes around. Mm-hmm. And it just creates these really, really interesting networks that, you know, I haven't, and I know a lot of people across the, you know, different healing arts and like, what do you, mm-hmm. does that make sense to you? Like, does that resonate in any way? Like having that like yeah. really strong network, or am I just making that yeah. up?
Definitely. And I mean, I think herbalism, I think a couple of things. One is I think that herbalism is really driven by the magical sort of healing powers and the spirit of the plant.
Yes.
And plants are really powerful healers, there are teachers, there are guides. And so I think there's something there in terms of like the modality that we're working with, the energy that we're working with is just so powerful.
But I
also think that the sort of sad history of herbalism in the United States and in other parts of the world as well, but I'll focus on our particular history, is that it's really been squashed by large, powerful forces.
Right.
So, you know, obviously like Native American healing traditions and Western herbal traditions that were really strong and robust in the United States up until the 1930s were really smushed and went underground. And so what we are living in is a very healthy revival. You know, healthy to an extent. I mean, it's still not so largely, it's not culturally dominant, but I would say that the revival is very healthy.
Absolutely.
And that for any revival to really take hold, you need a pretty strong movement and you need a lot of passion.
Yes.
And I think that some of the forebears of the revivalist movement from the 60s and mostly the 70s in the United States just have a lot of really authentically and genuinely motivated power and interest in organizing. You know, people like Rosemary Gladstar, who organizes herbal conferences here in the Northeast.
Love her so much.
Conferences like Brighton Bush out in California or in Oregon. It's in California, excuse me. You know, just like these kinds of networks that have really... It's the only way to know about it is through that. And so, and I think because it's a revivalist movement, the way that it has spread and the grassroots nature of it feels powerful in this way that maybe some other things that have had more resources or less adversity against them haven't had to deal with or face.
Yeah, that's really
interesting. I think the other important answer to the question is that herbalism is what I refer to as illegal. So when you practice herbal medicine, you're putting outside the law. Herbalism isn't, the practice of herbalism isn't dictated or governed by the state federally.
Right.
It just sort of exists as people's medicine, which I think is the way it should be. I'm sort of anti-legislation in herbalism. But what that means is that, you know, you have a group of people that are highly motivated and highly committed to the craft.
Right.
And the art, so to speak, and not like I know my mom's a nurse. She's an amazing nurse, and she has to do community education credits. So she too has to like continue to always learn, but it's and she enjoys it, but it's something that's dictated that her license requires.
Right.
And so as herbalists, we have to work so hard to not only get the information and to find it. It's just that natural evolution of staying in touch with the material. It's like when you love something that much, it just kind of happens naturally.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I totally get that. And I think that, you know, because... And also that sort of, you know, like has a little bit of a coattailing on that issue too, because it isn't formally regulated. Like it does help to have tons of resources and other people who have been doing it for a really long time to talk to and be like to cross-reference and say like, hey, like, you know, I need these herbs for my menstruation, but like I have X, Y, and Z going on, you know, what would you recommend? And how does this herb work with this herb? And I think that, There's books, of course, but there's also, you know, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of different learners out there. So having a person to kind of guide you and mentor you is invaluable. You know, there, you can't put a price on that. It's and it just creates, you know, deeper connections and communities in a way that is really, I don't know, fulfilling, you know, and nurturing, nourishing. So that's really cool. And, you know, something else that I think I had noticed on one of your titles, too, is that one of the pamphlets that you have is called Sacred and Mysterious, and it's Healing Wisdom and Herbal Lore for Those Who Menstruate. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose to use that phrasing with that title?
So the choice to write for those who menstruate is a choice to use gender-inclusive language because there's a lot of people that identify differently with their gender and their body who menstruate. And so the assumption that only women or menstruate is, I think, something that makes some people uncomfortable. And not only that, sort of denies access to people who might not identify as a woman or a female who menstruate. And I think that that is something that, so I'm really interested in making self-care as accessible to people as possible.
Absolutely.
Because I really believe in the healing power of self-care. And so to use gender-neutral language for me feels like it just increases accessibility. And I think it's, you know, I think we live in a time where people are becoming more and more expressive of gender identity. But
especially in this area, which is like, it's like a topic of conversation, like every day at the high schools, like it's huge around here. Like this is kind of a, you know, an academic think tank for like gender and queer identity out here.
And so, you know, it is respecting that, but it's also, it wasn't as big or as hot of a topic when I wrote that zine. And I think that so part of the motivation was and is to just create space for the ways that it might affect us on the unconscious level, right? So now it's much more conscious and in awareness. But, you know, I have friends, for example, that don't necessarily, like, they're not transgender, they're not changing their gender identity, or even identifying differently, but just kind of have this amorphous feeling around their gender, right? And so it makes space for people. So here we are, making space again.
That's what we're
doing. It makes space for people to have any kind of relationship with their body, with their gender, with their menstruation, and can kind of just bring that to the table in a more open way.
If you're just tuning in, this is Energy Matters, and I'm Caroline Rederman, the host, and we're interviewing Brittany Wood Nickerson, who is a local educator and author and herbalist. Anything that you have going on that you would like to touch on?
One, I know a lot of folks who are listening are probably local, but I'm going to be at a conference event in Somerville the first weekend in June 2nd and 3rd, at the Armory, called Herbstock.
Oh, cool.
And Herbstock is a really great community-inspired herbal networking and educational event at the Armory in Somerville. And it's 2 days, and they have a great herbal marketplace and lots of workshops with teachers, herbalists. So I'll be there teaching a class called Herbal Allies for Setting Boundaries and Intentions. And I'm also going to be there with my booth bending stuff, as well as stuff from Old Friends Farm and Full Moon Ghee.
That sounds fabulous. It sounds like a lot of fun. And thank you so much, Brittany. I really appreciate that you came on our show today. Absolutely go check out timeherbal.com and Brittany Wood Nickerson's cookbook. And, you know, a lot of her work is so amazing and so informational. She's a great resource for the local region and beyond. So again, thank you so much, Brittany, for coming on the show today. Have a great afternoon, and you've been listening to Energy Matters. Take care. Bye-bye.